From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, writing the songs for Fiddler on the Roof, including a new song for the new Broadway revival. We talk with composer Jerry Bock and lyricist Sheldon Harnick. There's a new cast recording of the revival, which stars Alfred Molina as Tevye. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg on swearing and how each era has its own words that have the power to offend. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Connecticut Governor John Rowland announced his resignation today, faced with a move to impeach him in a federal corruption investigation. The third-term Republican told supporters that his own poor judgment had brought him to this point, but he insisted that he was not guilty of influence peddling.
There comes a time in everyone's life when you realize it's time to take a new path. This is our time.
Rowland has admitted lying about accepting gifts and favors from state employees, contractors, and friends, but said he never used his office to help the givers. The governor's resignation will become effective on July 2nd. Lieutenant Governor Jody Rell will serve out the 2 years remaining in Rowland's term. Civil libertarians are reacting with dismay to today's Supreme Court decision upholding state laws that allow the jailing of people who refuse to disclose their identities to investigating police officers. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Some 20 states have laws that provide jail terms for people who refuse to identify themselves to police investigating suspicious circumstances. The Supreme Court upheld those laws by a 5-4 vote. The court called name identification insignificant in the greater scheme of things compared to the important value of the information for police. Civil libertarians criticized the ruling as undermining the traditional right of citizens to remain silent. Here's Tim Lynch of the Libertarian Cato Institute.
If an ordinary citizen is confronted with a police officer who is asking questions, that person can now be taken to jail for simply telling the officer he doesn't want to answer those questions.
Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
A military judge in Baghdad has ruled, for now at least, that the trial of 2 U.S. soldiers accused in the prisoner abuse scandal will not be moved to the United States. NPR's Emily Harris says the judge refused a request from the defense.
Defense lawyers want to get the trial out of Iraq, particularly because if the trial is in America, they can compel witnesses to come and testify. Members of the military can be compelled to testify anyway, but the defense lawyers want to interview and possibly call as witnesses a number of civilians, civilian government officials, particularly civilian contractors who were working as interrogators in Abu Ghraib at the time that this abuse was going on.
NPR's Emily Harris reporting from Baghdad. Defense attorneys will be allowed to seek the testimony of the top U.S. general in Iraq and the chief of the U.S. Central Command. Iraqi insurgents killed 4 American service members in Ramadi today. Brigadier General Mark Kimmett said a U.S. quick reaction force found the bodies after the troops failed to report to their base. In stocks, the Dow lost 45 to close at 10,371. The Nasdaq was down 12 to 1974. This is NPR News. A rocket plane flew above the Earth's atmosphere today to become the first privately financed manned flight into space. The plane, called Spaceship One, was lifted to a height of 46,000 feet by a larger plane. Then it used its rocket engine to carry it to just above 62 miles, considered the boundary between the Earth's atmosphere and space. The flight makes Spaceship One eligible for a $10 million prize, but the plane must repeat its achievement within 2 weeks. And the plane's developers say the plane's design shows that commercial space flights and space tourism could become a reality. Doctors at a Washington, D.C. hospital say Jade and Aaron Buckles are making good progress. The girls were born in February as conjoined twins and separated by surgeons over the weekend. Now the parents say the family wants to get on with life. NPR's Joseph Shapiro reports.
The father, Kevin Buckles, said that as the girls grow up, He and his wife, Melissa, won't make a big deal of the way their daughters started life.
Once all of this goes away, all the cameras goes away, and we'll just be a normal family, you know, and that's all we want. Yeah, we appreciate everybody's thoughts and prayers, but you know, hopefully in 2 years you won't remember us and you'll go on with your lives.
Jade and Aaron were born nearly 4 months ago, connected from the chest to the abdomen. Doctors at Children's National Medical Center say the girls remain in critical but stable condition and will stay in the hospital for several weeks. The girls were separated in a 6-hour surgery on Saturday. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the S&P 500 lost 4 points to close at 1,130. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, reporting in its magazine, FFR, on Nigeria's new approach to fighting AIDS in Africa, on the web at fordfound.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are composer Jerry Bock and lyricist Sheldon Harnick. They co-wrote the songs for the Broadway musicals Fiorello, She Loves Me, and Fiddler on the Roof. There's a new cast recording of the current Broadway revival of Fiddler, starring Alfred Molina as Tevye, the role originated by Zero Mostel. Tevye is a husband, father, and milkman in Anatevka, a small Jewish village in Tsarist Russia. The year is 1905. Here's Alfred Molina in the opening of the new cast recording.
A fiddler on the roof sounds crazy, no? But in our little village of Anatevka, you might say every one of us is a fiddler on the roof, trying to scratch out a pleasant, simple tune without breaking his neck. It isn't easy. You may ask, why do we stay up here if it's so dangerous? We stay because Anatevka is our home. And how do we keep our balance? That I can tell you in a word. Tradition!
Tradition! Tradition! Tradition! Tradition! Tradition!
Fiddler on the Roof opened on Broadway in September 1964 and ran for 3,242 performances, which was a Broadway record. It's since been performed around the world. The show's book by Joseph Stein was based on the stories of the Yiddish writer Shalom Aleichem. Sheldon Harnick and Jerry Bock wrote a new song for the new revival at the request of the show's director. Here's Jerry Bock speaking first.
David Laveau gently but most persuasively approached us and said, would you two consider writing a new song for the score? And there was a quiet but discernible shock at the assignment. We were totally unprepared for that kind of gentle request. And then we had to be persuaded that this particular song, which was to replace the original gossip song in Fiddler, was merited, was possible, and could we and would we take it on?
What was the perceived problem?
Well, this is Sheldon Harnick speaking. The problem was that the song was supposed to be for the matchmaker, Yenta. The appealing thing, before I tell you the problem, the appealing thing was, as David pointed out, most of the songs in the score deal one way or another with tradition, either the preservation of it or the changing of it. And as David said, you haven't dealt with the tradition of the matchmaker, which was changing at that time. And that's what he wanted us to explore musically. So that was an appealing idea. The problem was, at that point in the show, as a lyricist, I thought, I'm not sure I can find anything for her to say that we haven't already heard. I don't know that there's anything new there, and consequently, as clever as I might be, it still could turn out to be a stage wait. So that was a problem.
Well, here's another issue. You hadn't worked together in nearly 35 years.
No so, problem, not an issue.
Not an issue? How'd you feel about getting back together again? Were you on good terms?
It was like we never, Jerry Bock, it's like we never stopped.
When was the last time you'd spoken? When was the last time you'd actually, you know, been in the same room together?
Oh, for heaven's sakes. We,
endlessly.
We've we've remained friends for the all of our professional life. And I, even if we hadn't, we would have had to get together because there were constant problems or things to discuss about our previous shows. So we've always had to maintain a relationship. And as it happens, it's been an amiable one.
Jerry Bock, Terry, we weren't divorced. We were romantically separated.
Okay. Well, Sheldon Harnick, tell us about the lyric that you wrote for this new song, Topsy Turvy.
When I confess, when I thought about the problem, my heart sank. But I thought, okay, let's give it a try and see what happens. And I fell into some ideas which I thought, yes, I think this could work. The problem was we were already, if I remember correctly, I think we were 2 weeks into rehearsal.
Yes.
When this happened. So I thought, oh my, it has to be done very quickly. And so I wrote a draft very quickly. And of course, when you write something, you're always, or usually you're quite pleased with what you write. I wrote it. I thought, oh, this is terrific. And I faxed it to Jerry, and Jerry read it, and he said, oh, this is fine. Then during the rest of that day, while Jerry presumably was off writing the music, I looked at the music, at the lyric with a colder eye, and I thought, oh, for heaven's sakes, I've written this so fast, there's practically no form to it. I don't know how Jerry can deal with this. So the next day I called him very contritely and I said, I think I gave you an impossible assignment. Jerry, in effect, said, yes, you did. And we had to start over again.
Bock speaking now, the thing that captured me musically was the possibility of adding what only had been suggested in our score, which was to really deal with the possibility of a klezmer musical background for this particular moment.
So are you saying that there was any more or less of a klezmer sound to this song?
Yes, there is.
More of it.
More of it.
More than less.
Okay.
There was another problem.
But less is more.
There was another problem. Actually, it turned out not to be a problem, but we thought it might be. Yenta, at that time, was Barbara Berry, who's a wonderful actor, but we had no idea whether how musical she was and what kind of demands or challenges she could handle musically. And as I wrote the lyric, I kept thinking, well, let's see. I think these lines, if necessary, can be spoken, and they can be handled actorly rather than singerly. So that was a consideration. Then there was another consideration. The number that it replaced, the gossip song, had originally been written actually as a scene change. It was a different physical approach to the show, and we needed something while a new set was being put into place. So the number, the gossip number, really didn't have too much to do with the show. What it did have was energy and humor. And when I looked at the score in the second act, I thought the energy and the vitality of that number are necessary because much of the second act score, while being, I think, very beautiful, is also rather gentle, rather lyrical. So when we approached the song for Yenta, we thought we have to preserve that feeling of animation. Then it was a time-consuming, give-and-take approach. I would give Jerry a lyric, and he was able to set the choruses, but not the verses. And then Joe Stein came into it, our book writer, and Joe read what we were doing, and he had his comments, and some of them were negative, so I had to throw out certain things that I'd written and start over. What Jerry did, which actually solved the problem eventually of the verses, rather than trying futilely to set what I had given him, which I think was unsettable, he wrote some music and said, how's this? And when I listened to the music, the first thing I thought was, oh, dear, what can I salvage? What that I already have is going to fit this music? And luckily, much of what I'd written fit it.
So Barbara Berry was going to be, you mentioned this was written initially with Barbara Berry in mind, but she didn't actually make it to the show, and Nancy Opel sings the part of the matchmaker. So why don't we hear Nancy Opel singing the part of the matchmaker in the new cast recording of Fiddler on the Roof.
love to.
It's all topsy-turvy. No? Yes. The world is a shambles.
A mishmash.
It's a mess.
We all have our troubles. Right?
Right.
And mine is my living. It changed overnight. And why? I'll tell you why. Young people, all of a sudden, everyone knows better than me. Who needs Yenta? Why come to me when more and more they don't want marriage?
No.
No, it seems today they all insist on wedded bliss. A simple match is not for them. They'll only marry for love.
They want to be happy.
They want to be happy. What kind of match is this?
It's all topsy-turvy. Right?
Right. The world is a riddle.
A muddle.
And a blight. The matchmaking business finished. Done.
But still, count your blessings.
I counted. None. Young people, they're all crazy.
That's Topsy Turvy, a new song composed by Sheldon Harnick and Jerry Bock for the new revival of Fiddler on the Roof, and the cast recording of that revival has just come out. How did you first start writing together? Well, I should mention that the other shows that you've done include Fiorello and She Loves Me.
Jerry was with a publisher named Tommy Volando, and he was looking for a lyricist, and Tommy knew my work from the reviews to which I had contributed songs, and it was Tommy Volando who put us together. We had actually met socially. I was called in to try and repair lyrics or add new lyrics to a show called Shangri-La, and in the show was Jack Cassidy.
Jack Cassidy, Bach here, was our matchmaker.
Yes.
He introduced us, and slowly and surely we began to get to know each other. And both ended up in Tommy Volando's office, who made it a professional arrangement that we would become a words and music team.
My guests are lyricist Sheldon Harnick and composer Jerry Bock. They wrote the songs for Fiddler on the Roof. The cast recording of the new Broadway revival has just been released. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are composer Jerry Bock and lyricist Sheldon Harnick. They wrote the songs for Fiddler on the Roof. The story is set in 1905 in Anatevka, a Jewish village in Tsarist Russia. Jerry Bock, when you were writing the music for Fiddler on the Roof, how Jewish did you want the music to sound? How much did you want it to sound like klezmer music, and how much did you want it to sound like Broadway music?
It never entered my mind in either case. I knew the ambience was going to be Russian and that it took place in a shtetl, but I had no compulsion to research either early klezmer or particularly Russian music at the turn of that century or just before the turn of the century. What happened was that for some inexplicable reason, the music that I hadn't been able to write with all our shows was something that I had silently deposited in my creative mind. And the opportunity to now express myself with that kind of music just opened up a flood of possibilities for me.
Well,
the only piece of music that I can think of that was definitely influenced by some Jewish music was If I Were a Rich Man, because Jerry and I had gone down to see a Hebrew actor's union benefit. We went down looking to see whether there was any performers in that that would be useful for our show, and there was one. There was a man named Svi Schuller who became our innkeeper. But as part of the entertainment, a mother and daughter came out, and they did a Hasidic chant, all in thirds and sixths, with just syllables, no actual words. And Jerry called me the next day saying he'd been so taken with this that it's inspired him to write something similar.
And that was a collaborative thing again, because what affected us was both the word chant as well as the accompanying music. But once again, I think we converted it into our own variation of same.
Right.
Well, Sheldon
Harnick, after all, it's only part. It's only part. I don't want to put it down because I think it's a surprising part and an endearing part of the whole song, If I Were a Rich Man.
Well, I'm going to play If I Were a Rich Man, and this is the only track that I'm going to play from the original cast recording because Zero Mostel is so famous for how he interpreted this song. So let's hear Zero Mostel from the original cast recording doing If I Were a Rich Man.
Dear God, you made many, many poor people. I realize, of course, that it's no shame to be poor, but it's no great honor either. So what would have been so terrible if I had a small fortune? If I were a rich man, all day long I'd biddy biddy bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. If I were a biddy biddy rich, idle diddle 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 man, I'd build a big tall house with rooms by the dozen right in the middle of the town. A fine tin roof with a real wooden floors below. There couldn't be one long staircase just going up and one even longer coming down. And one more leading nowhere just for show. I'd fill my yard with chicks and turkeys and geese and ducks for the town to see and hear, squawking just as noisily as they can. And each loud will land like a trumpet on the ear, as if to say here lives a wealthy man. If I were a rich man.
A Zero Mostel from the original cast recording doing If I Were a Rich Man. There's a new cast recording from the new revival that's out, and we'll hear more from that in a moment. My guests are Sheldon Harnick, who wrote the lyrics to the show, and Jerry Bock, who wrote the music. And by the way, they wrote a new song for the new revival. Sheldon Harnick, the yidle deedle digga digga doo part.
Right.
Did you actually write out the syllables that you wanted Zero Mostel to sing?
Well, it wasn't that I necessarily wrote them for Zero, but what happened was this. When Jerry played me the music he wrote, he did the whole song in that kind of a Hasidic chant. And we decided that it would be great fun to preserve part of the chant and not just to write wall-to-wall lyrics for the song. But my problem was, I don't come from a background where I was comfortable chanting in that fashion. And I thought, okay, I'll have to create some kind of syllables which give the effect of that kind of chanting. And I came up with the diddle deedle diddle digga digga deedle diddle dum, which I thought was kind of fun and sounded a little like the chanting. But when we played the song for Zero, he said... I come from a background. I don't want to do the syllables you've written. Is it okay with you if I do it the way I think it should be done? And I said, absolutely. I said, I can't sing it that way. So Zero did it with his stylistically. It sounded quite
authentic.
Authentic, yeah. So when I perform the song, I have to do it with the syllables because that's the only way I can sing it.
By the way, if Sheldon had said no, absolutely not, you must do the lyric, he would have done it. He would have done it his way anyway.
Right.
Was he hard or easy to work with?
He was in terms of music. He was although he was not a singer, he was extremely musical.
Yes.
So that in that sense, he was very easy. And as a matter of fact, he did me a huge favor. After he started to learn If I Were a Rich Man, I got nervous about it because I thought most of the song is rather droll. And then I went for a serious ending, and I began to worry whether I should change the ending and make the ending droll also. So I suggested that in a conference we had one day. I think Hal Prince was there and Jerome Robbins and Zero. And Zero looked at me and said, Sheldon, he said, don't change the ending. If you want to, this is the man. He said, it's the jokes in the song are terrific, but this is the man that you've described, the man who wants a seat by the Eastern Wall, who wants to be able to pray. This is the real Tevye. So he saved, and we kept the ending, and I'm glad we did.
I'm glad, too.
Lyricist Sheldon Harnick and composer Jerry Bock wrote the songs for Fiddler on the Roof. The cast recording of the new Broadway revival has just been released. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
It's a miracle of miracles. God took a Daniel once again, stood by his side, and miracle of miracles, walked him through the lion's den. Wonder of wonders, miracle of miracles, I was afraid that God would frown, but like he did so long ago in Jericho, God just made a wall fall down. When Moses softened Pharaoh's heart, that was a miracle. When God made the waters of the Red Sea part, that was a miracle too. But of all God's miracles, large and small, the most miraculous one of all is that out of a worthless lump of clay, God has made a man today. Wonder of wonders, miracle of miracles, God took a tailor by the hand, turned him around, and miracle of miracles led him to the promised land. When David slew Goliath, yes, that was a miracle. When God gave us manna in the wilderness, that was a miracle too. But of all God's miracles, large and small, the most miraculous one of all is the one I thought could never be. God has given you to me.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the Sundance Channel, presenting the TV premiere of Our House, a documentary about children of gay and lesbian parents, on Sundance Channel tonight at 9. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with songwriters Sheldon Harnick and Jerry Bock about Fiddler on the Roof. Also, a swear word that would have offended in the 1870s doesn't have the same power today. Linguist Jeff Nunberg considers how the times and the profanities have changed. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with composer Jerry Bock and lyricist Sheldon Harnick. They wrote the songs for the Broadway musicals Fiorello, She Loves Me, and Fiddler on the Roof. There's a new cast recording of the current Broadway revival of Fiddler. Here's one of the show's most popular songs, To Life, performed by Alfred Molina as Tevye and David Wall as the butcher Laser Wolf. They're drinking a toast because Tevye has just agreed to let the butcher marry Tevye's daughter, Seidel.
Let's drink on it.
Why not? To you.
No, my friend. To you.
To the both of us.
To our agreement.
To our agreement. To our prosperity. To good health and happiness. But most important, to life, to life, l'chaim. L'chaim, l'chaim, to life. Here's to the father I've tried to be.
Here's to my bride-to-be.
Drink l'chaim, to life, l'chaim. L'chaim, l'chaim, to life. Life has a way of confusing us,
blessing and bruising us.
Drink l'chaim to life. God would like us to be joyful, even when our hearts lie panting on the floor.
How much more can we be joyful when there's really something to be joyful for?
To life, l'chaim. To Seidel, my daughter,
my wife. It gives you something to think about.
Something to drink about. Drink l'chaim to life.
Remotka.
Yes, Laser Wolf.
Drinks for
music from the new cast recording of Fiddler on the Roof. And my guests are Jerry Bock, who wrote the music, and Sheldon Harnick, who wrote the lyrics. They also collaborated on other shows, including Fiorello and She Loves Me. This is the only song that actually has a Yiddish word in it, l'chaim, which is a toast to life. So, Sheldon Harnick, when you were writing the lyrics, it seems to me you intentionally avoided using anything Yiddish, with the exception of this song.
Well, there is one other song. The Dream uses the word mazel tov.
Oh, that's true. A blessing on your head, mazel tov, yeah. Mazel tov.
Well, there was a reason for that. Not too long before we went into rehearsal, I went to see a comedian named Lenny Bruce. I'd heard that Lenny Bruce was controversial because he used a lot of profanity and obscenities in his act. And I was curious. So I went to see him, and it turned out that the obscenities and the profanities were all done as characters that he portrayed, and so that they sounded like things those particular characters would actually say. And I wasn't disturbed by the profanity or the obscenity at all. What did disturb me was that when he wasn't doing the characters and he was just talking, he would throw in Yiddish words. And they would elicit laughter from a few people here and there. But many of the other people in the club turned to each other and said, "What did he say? What did he say?" So I thought it'll be probably useful to use a couple of Yiddish words in our show, in the dialogue and in the lyrics, just a couple for flavoring. But if anyone laughs when they're used, then they come out. And also, when they're used, they have to be used in a way that the audience will know what they mean. So, of course, in To Life, there's an explanation that goes along with the Yiddish word. Right. To life, l'chaim, l'chaim. Nobody can miss that. And the word mazel tov is usually used in a setting where it's pretty clear that it means congratulations.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Good fortune.
Unhappily, after the show was running, the original show was running, our dear star Zero would occasionally go into a matinee and use more Yiddish than we ever could have dreamed of in certain performances to sort of make him a confidant of what he thought that kind of audience was. We all thought that was naughty, to put it mildly.
Did you yell at him afterwards?
Yes, yes. Joe Stein made a terrible mistake one day. We were in the audience when he used a kind of really naughty Yiddish word. And we went backstage, and Joe said to him, he said, "Zero, you're wonderful today. Buddy Hackett couldn't have done it better." And Zero was furious, and he said, "What do you mean by that?" And Joe said, "Zero, do you have to add those kind of words, especially the words that have the naughty implications. And Zero kind of did what he wanted. So yeah. It was another 2 weeks before he would take those words out. And then when he thought, okay, I've done it enough, then he took it out. So that answers your question. Yes, he was difficult, but audiences adored him. You know, even whatever he did, usually what he did was so funny that audiences just loved him.
By the way, Terry, excuse me for interrupting, but I think it's time now, after celebrating Zero, to say that Alfred Molina, for us in this renewal, not revival, is extraordinary and takes the role in another vision and another way that succeeds in its own right, so that the accomplishment of a performer after Zero made the stars shine. Alfred did his own thing and does his own thing in a most remarkable way.
Zero had a way of making every scene about himself. And Fred Molina is the most generous of actors, so that it's more of an ensemble show now. People have commented to me that in this production, the other stories, the young people's stories, are come across with much more clarity and much more force, and consequently, in the second act particularly, it's a much more emotional show. It's a much more moving show.
That is a consequence of a remarkable director. I'll add another visionary that was an enormous contributor to this new production, David Laveau, who insisted that everyone in the community have an identity, an assignment, something that the actor can use to great advantage, so that we didn't end up with a dancing chorus or a singing chorus. We ended up with a community of people, each whom had their work to do, their emotional levels to respond to whatever was happening in the community, and it gave it much more of a sense of an entire shtetl. And Alfred, of course, as Sheldon said, was more than willing, in fact, often insisted on communicating with all the people in the community as one member of that community as well.
My guests are lyricist Sheldon Harnick and composer Jerry Bock. They wrote the songs for Fiddler on the Roof. The cast recording of the new Broadway revival has just been released. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are composer Jerry Bock and lyricist Sheldon Harnick. They wrote the songs to Fiddler on the Roof. The new cast recording of the current Broadway revival has just been released.
Now, I want to go to another song, and that is Do I Love You? And
Do You Love Me?
Do You Love Me?
No, Do You Love
We're
Me?
Very flattered.
It's Do You Love Me? Do I Love You? Yes. So,
will we please answer that question?
and this is a song, all of Tevye's daughters, like, they want to fall in love. They don't want Tevye to set up. They don't want their father Tevye to decide who they're going to marry. They don't want the matchmaker to decide it. At this point, they want to fall in love, and at least one of them already has. And she wants to marry the man she loves. And this is leading Tevye to wonder, well, what about his relationship? Does his wife love him? What is love? And he sings the song, and it's a lovely song. Sheldon Harnick, can you talk about the lyric?
Yes. During rehearsal, when we were in New York, I began to feel that there was a song that would develop out of Tevye's saying, "Do you love me?" I always thought when Golda would say, "Do I what?" Because that was love was not something that people married for generally in those days. They married for security. They married for economic reasons, you know, companionship, but not love. So when I pictured her saying, "Do I what?" I thought, that's very funny. But I couldn't figure out where the song went from there. And when we got to Detroit, our pre-Broadway tour, I used to take long walks every day and try and figure out what they would say. And the lyric came very slowly and in a kind of unconventional form. When I finally finished it, after about a week, I gave it to Jerry, very uncertain about what I had. And I said, I know that it looks more like a scene than a song, so do what you can with it, and if I have to rewrite the lyric, I will. And I was absolutely delighted when Jerry set the lyric exactly as I gave it to him.
I just wanted to add very quickly, Terry, that the difference between Zero's "Do You Love Me" and Alfred's is astonishing. Zero did get laughs. He approached it as almost a kind of incredulous question to ask, and took advantage of every humorous possibility. Alfred does it most sincerely. In terms of a true and real question, he wants to know the answer, and as a result, it's a very moving moment rather than a humorous one in this current production.
Yeah, and while we're on that subject, I just have to put in a word that our Golda, Randy Graff, is in her own way, she's as wonderful as Fred Molina is.
Yes.
Well, let's hear Alfred Molina and Randy Graff from the new cast recording of Fiddler on the Roof. This is "Do You Love Me?"
Golda. Do you love me?
Do I what?
Do you love me?
Do I love you? With our daughters getting married and this trouble in the town, you're upset, you're worn out. Go inside, go lie down. Maybe it's indigestion.
Golda, I'm asking you a question. Do you love me?
You're a fool.
I know. But do you love me?
Do I love you?
Well?
For 25 years I've washed your clothes, cooked your meals, cleaned your house, given you children, milked the cow. After 25 years, why talk about love right now?
Golda, the first time I met you was on our wedding day. I was scared.
I was shy.
I was nervous.
So was I.
But my father and my mother said we'd learn to love each other. And now I'm asking, Golda, do you love me?
I'm your wife.
I know. But do you love me?
Do I love him?
Well,
for 25 years I've lived with him, fought with him, starved with him. 25 years my bed is his. If that's not love, what is?
Then you love me.
I suppose I do.
And I suppose I love you too.
That was "Do You Love Me" from the new cast recording of Fiddler on the Roof. My guests are Jerry Bock and Sheldon Harnick, who wrote the music and the lyrics for the show. It's interesting. Some of the songs from the show have had a huge life outside the show, and particularly "Sunrise Sunset," which has been sung at countless weddings and bar mitzvahs. But a song like "Do You Love Me," I think you're unlikely to hear it in a cabaret act or a nightclub or a pop recording or as a jazz standard. And I thought, well, you know, who's ever going to do a song like this? But there is a recording by Cannonball Adderley of the songs from Fiddler on the Roof that's recently been reissued on CD. And it's actually a wonderful recording. And there's a beautiful version of this song that just kind of brings out the melody of it. Have you ever heard it?
Yes, yeah.
We have. Yeah. Cannonball did a whole album.
Exactly. And what did you think about when you heard this? Just as, you know, played by jazz musicians, just as, you know.
I thought he approached the score with great respect and with great understanding. I just love what he did.
And by the way, Terry, there's a new jazz album that reaches equal heights, if not more so, by two fairly unknown jazz people, to the outsider, Eddie Lopez and Mark Kramer, did a very recently did a jazz version of the score, which I have an extra copy at home for you, Sheldon.
Good! I never heard of it.
well, for now, we'll hear. Do You Love Me from the Cannonball Adderley recording, and this was actually recorded just a month after Fiddler opened in 1964, and it's actually Charles Lloyd featured on saxophone on this track. Mm. Here we go. So that's music from the Cannonball Adderley recording of music from Fiddler on the Roof, which has recently been reissued on CD. And my guests are composer Jerry Bock and lyricist Sheldon Harnick, who wrote the songs for the show. Well, we're almost out of time here. I have to ask you the Sunrise Sunset question. I mean, so many people have... It's a song that became a terrible cliche for quite a while because everybody was doing it at those emotional moments when your child is finally grown up.
Favorite cliche.
Yes, exactly. And probably one of the most lucrative cliches, too. Did you ever think when you were writing it the kind of life the song was going to have?
No, Jerry had written the music first. He sent it to me on a tape, and I thought, gee, that's a lovely song. I think that would be perfect to sing at the wedding. And as I've said in an interview previously, the lyric kind of crystallized on the melodic curve of the song. When we finished it, Jerry was living in New Rochelle at the time. We called his wife down to the studio, and we played it for Patty. And when we looked at her at the end of the song, she was crying.
Tears in her eyes, yes.
And then I played it for my sister shortly after that, and she was crying. And we thought, ooh, this song probably has more effectiveness than we imagined.
Mind you, we didn't know whether they were tears of joy or that's awful.
Jerry Bock, what did you listen to when you were writing the show? Did you listen to much music?
Not really. Somehow, as I said, I had unknowingly, unwittingly stored a lot of the sound of it without having been able to express myself with it. I love Russian music. I love Romanian music. Minor is my major key. So with all that in mind, it just... I think Sheldon and I probably wrote maybe 3-1 for every song that was used. We wrote at least 3. And if we were asked to write 10 or 15 more, we probably could have, because it was the kind of show that allowed us to express ourselves as we had never expressed ourselves before.
I want to thank you so much, not only for talking with us, but thank you for all the great songs you've given us. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Jerry Bock and Sheldon Harnick wrote the songs for Fiddler on the Roof. The cast recording of the current Broadway revival has just been released. Here's Alfred Molina and Randy Graff from the new CD.
Is this the little girl I carried? Is this the little boy at play?
I don't remember growing older. When did they?
When did she get to be a beauty? When did he grow to be so tall?
Wasn't it yesterday when they were small?
Sunrise, sunset, sunrise, sunset, swiftly.
Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg on how every generation has its own way of swearing. This is Fresh Air. The HBO Western Deadwood, which just ended its first season, was noteworthy for the amount and nature of the swearing. According to our linguist Jeff Nunberg, the show managed to get the right effect with the wrong words.
Every age swears differently from the last one. It's as if we have to up the ante every generation or so. As Jonathan Swift once wrote, "Nowadays men change their oaths as often as they change their clothes." That can create problems for the writers of historical fictions. If you have your characters use historically accurate swear words, they're apt to sound no more offensive than your grandmother in a mild snit. The only way to convey the potency of their oaths is to have them use modern swear words, even if they're anachronistic. That's the approach taken by the HBO series Deadwood, which is set in a South Dakota mining camp in the 1870s. As a lot of people have noted, the show is positively swilling in obscenity. The characters use the F-word with a frequency that would make Tony Soprano blush. But the F-word wasn't actually a swear word back then. It was indecent, of course, but people only used it for the sexual act itself. Whereas swear words are the words that become detached from their literal meanings and float free as mere intensifiers. Swearing isn't using the F-word when you're referring to sex. It's using it when you're talking about the weather. In fact, when you look up the word in Jonathan Leiter's Dictionary of American Slang, you discover that the all-purpose insult F-U was a turn-of-the-century creation, and go F yourself isn't attested until 1920. And it wasn't until well into the century that you heard things like, she effing well better call me, or get the F out of here. The words those Deadwood characters would actually have used had religious overtones rather than sexual or scatological ones. They would have peppered their speech with goddamn, Jesus, and particularly hell, a word that Americans were famous for using with a dazzling virtuosity. A hell of a drink, what in hell did that mean? Hell to pay, the hell you will, hell yes. Back then, those oaths were strong enough to spawn a whole vocabulary of the substitutes that H.L. Mencken called denaturized profanities. Darn, doggone, dadburn, gee-whiz, all fired and the like. But those words sound comic to us now. If you put them into the mouths of the characters on Deadwood, they'd all sound like Yosemite Sam. One reason for the shift in swearing was that simple old-fashioned blasphemy doesn't have the same illicit thrill for a secular age. When I was a kid, I was always a little puzzled about the commandment about taking the Lord's name in vain. Not that I didn't know better than to try to say goddamn at the dinner table, but when people list the Ten Commandments, it's hard to see why the profanity rap should get a higher billing than murder, theft, or perjury. That change in attitudes is what drove the soldiers in World War I into the bedroom and bathroom looking for new boundaries to trespass. But that shift was more than a simple change of fashion. The old profanity was a matter of irreverence, using respectable words in disrespectful context. The new obscenity is the opposite of that. It's a kind of linguistic slumming, where we bring unclean words into the rooms at the front of the house. The taboo against profanity comes from on high. The taboo against obscenity comes from within. That shift had a lot to do with the great leveling of swearing in this century. The Victorians liked to think of swearing as a vice endemic to men of the lower orders, swearing like a trooper or swearing like a sailor. Nowadays, swearing isn't a mark of any particular class or gender. Those words are dirty little secrets we can all draw on when we find ourselves in an angry or aggressive mood. You don't find many people nowadays who will tell you that they never swear. Or if they do, they're most likely bragging about their even temper, not their gentility or their piety. The new rituals of swearing have altered the hypocrisy that surrounds it, too. Time was that swear words were completely absent from public discourse, and genteel people could go through their lives pretending that they didn't exist. Nowadays, it's more a question of maintaining an official sanctimony in designated public forums. You can use the F word in the New Yorker, but not in the New York Times. Bill Maher can swear on HBO, but not on CBS. And Stephen Sondheim can use the S word in a song in Sweeney Todd when it plays in theaters, but public radio shows are apt to have qualms about playing the song over the air. Of course, we have to draw a line somewhere if swearing's going to have any transgressive force at all. The wonder is that people can defend distinctions like those with a keen moral fervor. The Victorians would have had a hard time understanding how our sense of outrage about swearing can fluctuate according to where we are on the dial.
Jeff Nunberg is a Stanford linguist and author of the new book, Going Nuclear: Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of How to Think Like Leonardo da Vinci, 7 Steps to Genius Every Day by Michael J. Gelb. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Pamela Constable, the Washington Post's Kabul bureau chief. She's written a memoir about covering crises around the world, including Afghanistan, Iraq, and Pakistan, and how the work has affected her personal life. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.